From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, comic Gerard Carmichael, his NBC sitcom The Carmichael Show, tackles complicated, often uncomfortable topics, like when his character buys tickets to take his girlfriend to see Bill Cosby, and she refuses to go.
The same woman who, despite many accusations, continues to listen to Michael Jackson.
Well, if she's listening to Michael Jackson, I can go see Bill Cosby.
His stand-up can make you squirm, like when he says, I'm starting to appreciate slavery. You want to take it from there?
Oh, we should definitely do like a go on the road. You just say a very controversial thing and then just pass me the mic. We're lucky there was slavery. Gerard, you want to take it from me? Well, yes, Terry, I will take it from here.
And he will. Also, reviews of a new Sonny Rollins album and a Betsy Lerner memoir. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, comic Gerard Carmichael, is the creator and star of the NBC sitcom The Carmichael Show, which is now in its second season. A New York Times Magazine article described Carmichael as having, quote, one of stand-up's most unorthodox approaches to exploring race and class, unquote. In his sitcom, the characters of Gerard Carmichael, his girlfriend, his parents, and his brother typically end up in disagreements about subjects like, once you know all the allegations against Bill Cosby, is it still okay to watch his show? If your father, who abused you and your mother, dies, do you still deliver a nice eulogy? Should you see a therapist for depression, or is depression just something that afflicts white affluent people who have the time and money to worry about such things? Here's a scene from the episode about Cosby. Gerard has presented his girlfriend with two tickets for them to see Bill Cosby perform his stand-up act, but she refuses to go because of the allegations of sexual abuse. He figures maybe someone else in the family will want to go. They visit his parents' house, where his brother also lives, and they all get into a big discussion about whether it's okay to go. Gerard speaks first.
For me, this whole thing isn't about guilt or innocence. It's about the fact that the Cosby Show was so important. I mean, it brought my family together. It made us realize we could go to college. I mean, we didn't, but we knew we could, and that ain't nothing.
That doesn't change the fact that he's a horrible human being. Allegedly.
Continue.
Look, Maxine, just face it. Talent is more important than morals.
What, more important? According to who?
According to you, the same woman who, despite many accusations, continues to listen to Michael Jackson.
Well, if she's listening to Michael Jackson, I can go see Bill Cosby.
Come on, give me a break. Everybody listens to Michael Jackson.
And that's my point. Everyone should listen to Michael Jackson. Even his victims should listen to his music. I mean, they probably need it more than we do. They've been through a lot.
Well, the boy's got a point. I mean, I support gay rights, but I still eat at Chick-fil-A, like a lot. Like four times a week. Maybe I don't support gay rights.
You're being hypocritical, Maxine. Aren't you the same person who saw Blue Jasmine during the height of the Woody Allen scandal just putting money directly into his pockets?
Fine. If you don't go see Bill Cosby, then I will never go see a Woody Allen film again.
No, I'm not judging you for seeing his movies. You should see them. He's a great artist. I'm just saying you need to separate people's personal life from their work. I mean, anybody's capable of doing something violent or disgusting, but the list of people with genuine talent is limited. So talent trumps morals.
Does this mean I could go back to listening to Chris Brown?
Gerard Carmichael, welcome to Fresh Air. So we've gotten a sense of some of the format of your show. It usually takes an issue, and then the characters who are the regulars, the Gerard Carmichael character, his girlfriend, his parents, his brother, his ex-sister-in-law, all kind of weigh in and disagree with each other and try to, like, resolve it in some way and keep peace in the family. So,
yeah.
How did that become the premise of the show? Like, why did you want that to be your show?
It's kind of the premise of my life. So it worked. It's a very real thing. I grew up in a household that's very argumentative and, you know, a lot of times in a very healthy way. And my friends and I try my life, I like to say, is like populated like Lincoln's cabinet. You know, it's just a bunch of people that disagree with me and us on a quest for the truth. So that's kind of what we do. That's who I am and who my friends and my family are. So it just made sense for the show.
My impression from the show is that you think a lot of people have things that they don't want to admit to. They think things they don't want to admit to.
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of things. It's as a comedian, it's kind of my job to mine those thoughts. And you know when you've stumbled upon a truth, a hard truth, or something that, you may even feel uncomfortable saying into a microphone, and that's when you know you've got some gold.
So how many of these episodes come out of your life?
The perspective is real. More so than the situation, the perspective is very real. The perspective is a lot of times from my life and my real life perspective. I have my family on the show. They portray my family, and I'm using real names, so I try and be very mindful of their privacy and even my own privacy. And
but you're
and
using their real names or just your real name?
I'm using theirs too.
I didn't realize that.
I did that, yeah, Joe and Cynthia Carmichael. Joe, just inviting identity theft.
I'm glad I'm not in your family.
Yeah, I know, but they're excited. They're really excited by it. I mean, because the perspective is so real, you know, the reason I use my real name for the show and even my parents to a certain extent is because it holds me accountable. It makes me really, I mean, you care because it's your show and it's your project, but it holds you accountable. A thing with your name on it, you want to protect and you want to be the best version that it could possibly be. If your welcome mat of your home had your last name on it, you would wipe some leaves off of it every now and then, I'd imagine. You kind of keep it looking decent. You don't want your name to, you know, have anything on it. So that's how I feel about the show. I want to protect it, and I want my real name, and I want my real perspective.
So another episode, and you can tell me if this does or does not relate to your life. In one episode, your father finds out that his estranged father has just died, and he's expected to give a eulogy, and he doesn't know what to say because his father beat him and beat his mother, and he doesn't like his father. So how do you deal with the death of someone who never paid attention to you, mm-hmm. abused you, abused your mother, left the family, never gave any money, and so on? So is that something that you've witnessed in your family or in others?
Yeah, it is a thing where you, I've seen that, even in my own life. I remember, you know, being asked to like sing at my grandfather's funeral and having, you know, I was young at the time, but even realizing that the relationship wasn't that healthy on that side. And, you know, just and even over the years, friends, yeah, unfortunately, you know, I've lost a few friends, and just seeing that happen repeatedly is why we wanted to do the episode. It was about, well, what do you say? Like, when this person is no longer here, do you then like lie and you make up an emotion and you make up facts, or, you know, out of respect, or are you obligated to tell the truth?
The thing is, as a comic, I think you see it as your job to be a truth teller. That's funny. Yes. But in real life, sometimes it's better not to tell the truth and to say the thing that is the appropriate thing. So let me offer an example of a time when you probably were less than completely honest about what was on your mind. And I'm thinking mm-hmm. of the time you actually met Bill Cosby at his home. And I'm guessing that you didn't say, did you really do, why did you, how could you possibly have done that to
him? Well, when I met him, and this is, in all honesty, that hadn't broken yet. This was years ago. And so I met him, you know, just as a fan of his work, as you know, someone who really admired what he did in comedy and sitcoms and with his career. And so I met him in that capacity. So we talked comedy and television. That, you know, that was our conversation. And it was a good conversation. You know, it was a good conversation.
What did the Cosby Show mean to you when you were growing up?
A lot. It's fun. It was a fun family. It was a beautiful black family that, you know, you hadn't seen this family exist on television before. And it was fun. It was great. We all aspired to be, you know, that family singing on the stairs. And it was fun and a great experience to watch with your family. I think many of us did. That's what made the episode, I think, so exciting to do, because I think that it touched on a nerve of emotion that many of us felt. And rather, it was for Bill Cosby or someone else, I think we've all had to deal with that. I mean, just even in the clip that you played, I mean, Michael Jackson and Woody Allen and all these people who had gone through similar things. And it's like, oh, well, what do you do if this is a person you're a fan of? What do you do? What do you do in this instance? Do you burn the records? Do you still listen? But is that experience ruined, or are you able to just block out? Like, it's just so many questions around it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gerard Carmichael, and he created and stars in the NBC sitcom The Carmichael Show, which is on Sunday nights. Let's take a short break here, then we'll talk some more, and we'll hear some of your stand-up. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is comic and actor Gerard Carmichael, and his NBC series, The Carmichael Show, is shown Sunday nights, and it's a family sitcom. He's also a stand-up comic, and Gerard, I'd like to play an example of your stand-up comedy, and this is from your HBO special from 2014, Love at the Store, which was recorded live at the Comedy Store, and the HBO version of this was directed by Spike Lee. So here's Gerard Carmichael.
Am I gonna forget where I came from? Of course I am. Like, almost immediately. Like, I don't even like the term give back to the community because it implies the community gave me in the first place. Which they didn't. The community stole my bike. That's what the community did. The community. Like, I don't know if you guys ever watch movies like Dangerous Minds, but if you did, you know there's always two types of inner city youth, you know? There's reachable, that was me, and then there's hopeless niggas. And I was reachable, you know? Like in the movie, his name is usually Jamal. And like Jamal's in a gang, but he writes poetry in secret on the weekends, that was me. I was like Jamal. Do you know how many teachers have walked up to me at my desk and whispered in my ear, "You're not like the others." A lot, this happened a lot. Jamal always lives with his grandma, and like his grandma's always unreasonably ignorant toward education. Like he misses a few days of school and then Michelle Pfeiffer comes to his house and she knocks on the door and she's like, "You know, we really miss having Jamal in class." And then his grandma says some ignorant like, "Books don't put food on the table." You know, like some stupid like that? And you're like, it's that type of environment.
That's Gerard Carmichael from his HBO special, Love at the Comedy Store. So were you the kid who teachers whispered in your ear, "You're not like the others"?
Yeah, a lot.
How did you take that? Because it's nice to be considered, you know, the smart one and all that. But it's so dismissive of everybody else.
It is. Well, first of all, I think everybody has a certain amount of potential. It just has to be woken up. And I think it's kind of this chicken or egg thing where it's like, am I different because I'm told that I'm different? Or do I feel different? And then that just heightens it. That gives me license to embrace that when people tell you. So for me, you know, I express that through joke because I really think that a lot of kids from my situation or background are different, even if they don't know it, even if they don't know their own innate potential. And so that just highlights it. That joke is just meant to kind of highlight it. I wish that more people knew that.
So I should say, in that clip, some people listening to it will have been disturbed by the use of the word N-word. If you were me, would you have bleeped it?
No. Everybody should be able to say it. Like, what if we, you know, I'm very much so, you know, an advocate for let's strip the power away from it. It's like the more you hold a city, if you put something in a box and label it, you know, private, everybody's going to want to peek into that box. Everyone's going to think that it harnesses a certain amount of power. And so for me, it's just like, yeah, say it.
So describe the neighborhood where you grew up. You grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina?
Winston-Salem, North Carolina. It's a working class neighborhood, a lot of hardworking people. I grew up around, I guess you would describe the neighborhood as a inner city. It's, you know, it's a lot of hardworking people. And then there are some people who, by means of circumstance, have to, you know, resort to certain things, you know, to make money or whatever. And it's a lot of people that are struggling. And that's what I grew up around.
So you were singled out in school for being exceptional and smart and everything. But I can tell by watching you doing stand up that you're not a very, like, physically imposing guy. You're very thin. You don't strike me as being terribly tall. So was that an issue when you were growing up? Were you picked on because people could pick on you? If you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, you're kind of...
Actually, it's occurred to me.
I got picked on for not having, like, the coolest clothes.
Right, you mentioned that.
You know,
in,
or the coolest shoes that
yeah.
you find.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it doesn't matter who you are and your stature. And even the guy with the nice clothes could get picked on. No one was off limits. That, you know, that happened to me, and I'm both a victim of it, and I'm sure I contributed to that. None of us could really afford, you know, a bunch of expensive shoes, but we still picked on others for not having.
What was your method of self-defense?
Comedy became it gave me a very strong sense of self-worth. I remember kind of discovering it in eighth grade. And I discovered it through reading, and I discovered it through knowledge and being able to turn information and emotion on its head. And it's a thing that I remember kind of figuring out in the eighth grade, Mr. Nyeri's class. He had me read the newspaper every day. I started gathering information, and I just started having this insatiable, you know, thirst for information and news and how people felt. And that all contributes to my comedy. And I remember discovering it and using it, you know. And I became kind of the popular kid at a young age just through comedy. It was the funny guy. You know, people want to be around the funny guy.
So your father was a truck driver. I don't know if there were
Yes.
any people who you knew in your neighborhood who had gone on to, like, any kind of career in performance or show business. I think when you grow up without knowing people who can do that, it seems like a very distant dream, like a very out of reach ambition. So what made you think that you could actually do it? Because you, as far as I know, you moved to L.A., without a whole lot of experience trying to become a comic, and like you succeeded, but you must have either really been driven or you had the confidence that you could do it.
Yeah, well, first of all, growing up where I grew up, a lot of things that shouldn't feel unreachable. I didn't know people who made it in the entertainment industry, but I also didn't know any doctors. And I also didn't know any lawyers, and I didn't know, and just these things, and not seeing that and not being around that, you don't think that it's an option. You don't know what your options are. You don't know what you can do. And I was really blessed to have people that allowed me to realize that the world is mine as well.
So what was your parents' reaction when you told them you wanted to be a comic?
They'd never seen it happen before. They hadn't seen anyone make it or really knew any comedian. So it's a certain amount of caution. My mom, you know, was nervous because my announcement that I wanted to be a comic was the announcement that I was moving to Los Angeles. So that was all in one thing. So they had a double thing to deal with. They're like, all right, so you want to be a comedian in LA? Like, so you're going to go, you know, 2,000 miles away to try a thing that you've never tried before. It's a very strong amount of caution, but they were also excited, you know, also curious, I think. Why not? I didn't go to college, so it was like, why not? Let's see what happens.
Had you done any stand-up yet?
Not any stand-up. A friend of mine, Ashley, encouraged me to do stand-up. She told me, again, you're not like the others. She said, you don't think, you don't, you think like a comedian. You don't think, you know, you think in jokes and you think like, in a really specific way, and you should do stand up. And I kind of dismissed it and said, yeah, yeah, sure. And she was like, no, 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 you really have to do stand up. And then she refused to talk to me until I made plans to do stand up comedy. She just said, I won't talk to you until then. It kind of pressed me to just go, why not? And then my sister bought me a one-way plane ticket to LA, and then I told my parents I was moving, and boom.
You've had some good people in your life.
Some great people. I mean, some great moments. I remember being, I was working at a shoe store, and I remember feeling kind of lost, not really sure what I wanted to do in my life. I'm still just working at a, you know, at the shoe store with no direction, and a guy came in. And I'd already been kind of considering LA, and he came into the store one day, and you just kind of make the sales associate small talk and asked him what he did. And he said he was an actor. And I said, oh, really? I was like, that sounds like fun, man. I've always wanted to do that. And he said he lived in LA. And I was like, oh, man, I always wanted to go there. And he said, just move. And I was like, oh, oh, we could, you could just, you could do that. And he was like, yeah, go to Westside Rentals or Craigslist. I didn't have the $60 for Westside Rentals account. So I went on Craigslist and found an apartment and called my sister and said, I want to do this. And she got a plane. This all happened within like a couple of days. So I want to do it and then made plans to move to LA.
My guest is Gerard Carmichael. The second season of his sitcom, The Carmichael Show, is on NBC Sunday nights. We'll talk more after a short break. Also, Kevin Whitehead will review a new Sonny Rollins album of live recordings from 1979 to 2012. And Maureen Carrigan will review Betsy Lerner's new memoir about re-entering the life of her then 83-year-old mother. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program. Performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com. And from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and China, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with comic and actor Gerard Carmichael. He co-created and stars in the NBC sitcom The Carmichael Show, which is now in its second season. His 2014 HBO stand-up comedy special was directed by Spike Lee. He was also in the film Neighbors and is in the sequel, which will be released next month. When we left off, we were talking about growing up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and deciding to move to L.A. with no experience and no contacts. That was back in 2008 when he was 20. So you get to L.A., you have no experience doing stand-up, but it's your goal to do stand-up or to get a sitcom. Nothing in your life has given you any reason to truly believe that this could happen. So you get there, like, where do you start?
you hit open mics. I went to the Comedy Store first, and you go to the Comedy Store, the Improv, the Laugh Factory, these clubs I still do and that I still love, and you just jump in. You like that's that what I believe in more than anything is my ability to figure something out. So I moved to LA with the intention of figuring out stand-up comedy. And while I was excited about doing a sitcom and excited about acting, when I first moved, I was just doing stand-up comedy. I dedicated my life. I ignored the industry. If anything, I ran from the industry. I used to go to New York for pilot season so I could just do stand-up and just focus on that. And I didn't want to just be cast as a friend in a sitcom. I wanted to work on stand-up. I wanted to be great at stand-up. I don't see why you would do anything without the intention of being the best. So that was the goal. It was like, well, first, you know, the open mics, and then the shows that I'm on, and then whatever comes next comes next. So I just move with a lot of intention to figure it out.
Most comics have stories about their early days where they really bombed and it really hurt, and maybe it took another like week or month or year before they had the courage to go back on stage. Did you experience anything like that?
No, I've had moments. I've had some real moments of like just probably the worst bomb I ever had I'd been doing stand up for a couple of years, so it didn't shake my self esteem in any way, but it still hurt. But it wasn't like core shaking. I was in Baltimore, and a close friend of mine had just passed away, and I was rusty because it was after Christmas and I hadn't gone up in a while. And I remember getting on stage and just having the worst set ever. Just the worst set. People just talking and whatever. And I gave up control. It wasn't even that I lost it, is that I remember giving up. And that was a lesson in, you know, maintaining a certain drive and temperance, even while on stage, even when going through other emotions. If you don't incorporate it into what you're doing, then you shouldn't be doing it. So that was kind of a lesson in that. But my earlier days were fun. They were exciting. They were really exciting. I was around a great group of people who were like-minded, who genuinely dedicated their lives to the craft. Genuinely. It was hard for me to be around people if they did too many quote unquote normal things. if I were talking to a comic and he was like, oh yeah, well, I'm not going to go to this open mic. I'm going to go watch this football game. I'm like, oh, I don't think we could be friends. I don't think we have anything in common. It's like, yeah, I dedicated every fiber of my being to figuring out stand-up comedy.
So you do some really, like, I don't know what to make of that kind of comedy. Like, for example, in one of your comedy sets, you do something like, and forgive me for paraphrasing this. Forgive me for killing the joke. But
no, it's okay. But it's about the thought behind it now.
Okay, so you say something like, well, I'm lucky there was slavery because... Do you want to take it from there? Your turn.
That's the thing. Oh, we should definitely do like a go on the road, just Evan Costello. You just say a very controversial thing, and then just pass me the mic. It's like Terry just gets up. We're lucky there was slavery. Gerard, you want to take it from me? Well, yes, Terry, I will take it from here. Without doing the joke, the thought behind it is that without slavery, I wouldn't be in America. That's a guy dealing with taking this heinous, horrible thing that is slavery and trying to find a silver lining, which is that we are in America with a lot of opportunity. And it's like the question begs, would I trade slavery for this experience, or was slavery, and even the pain that, you know, you can use to motivate you, and the what's left over from it, do I take that and use it as fuel? And what do you do with it? It's that same question of like, well, what do I do with that? What do I do with the fact that slavery did bring us to America and that I am embracing the freedom that America provides? So in a sense, am I thankful that slavery happened? It's weird. And it's a weird thing that a lot of people, you know, shut down. You know, you hear buzzwords and you hear certain things and people are inclined to shut down and just dismiss it as, no, that's not a thought you're supposed to have, but it's a very real thought and a really real question. And so that's where the joke came from, without saying the joke itself.
You must get, though, some surprising, interesting reactions when you do that kind of jiu-jitsu comedy where you put out this premise that sounds like really weird, and it's not like you're endorsing it, but you're putting it out as this kind of challenging thing and turning it on its head and everything. So do people ever really take offense? Do you get booed? Like, what are some of the things that you have to deal with when you do that kind of comedy?
People, that's the challenge is earning the laugh, and the laugh is the reward for the thought. And some people, like I said earlier, like, they just shut down. Certain people shut down, and the fun thing is to try and win them back or get their attention and make them listen to what I'm actually saying. And so you sometimes have strong reactions, and I like that. I like when I'll put out a premise and the reaction is very strong, because that way I know you're listening. You're ready to hear, because it better be good. Whatever you say after this, it better be good. It better be worth this emotion that I'm expending.
That is why I handed the mic to you.
Yeah. Oh, our tour is going to be amazing.
I know,
you
I know.
And I just...
So on that note, let's take a short break.
Okay.
Then we'll be right back.
We'll work on the act a little bit more.
We'll work on the act, exactly.
You and I will work on...
I like it. Okay, my guest is Gerard Carmichael, and he has an NBC comedy series, which is called The Carmichael Show on Sunday nights. He's also a stand-up comic and actor. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the financial services firm of Raymond James, offering personalized wealth management advice and banking and capital markets expertise, all with a commitment to putting clients' financial well-being first. Learn more at RaymondJames.com. And from TIAA, whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is comic, actor, and writer Gerard Carmichael. He has an NBC sitcom that's on Sunday nights called The Carmichael Show. It's a family sitcom. And in 2014, he had an HBO comedy special called Love at the Store that was recorded live at the Comedy Store, directed by Spike Lee. Okay, so you have a network sitcom now. It's in its second season. We talked about the show earlier. It seems to me there's like certain pros and cons of having a network, or like a broadcast network sitcom, an NBC sitcom, as opposed to, say, an HBO half-hour comedy series. For example, there's language you can use on HBO that you can't use on network TV. There's a certain reach that you might have, that you definitely have on network TV, that you don't necessarily have on HBO, because it's a premium channel. You have to pay extra for it. A lot of people don't have it. So... you know, the HBO series don't have the studio audiences. The network half-hour series like yours tend to have the studio audience, so you hear the laughter on your show. So what are some of the things you like and some of the things that you wish you didn't have to do in the network version of the sitcom?
I really like all of it. I embraced it for a reason, and for that reason, because it is a challenge. I really like challenges, and doing the, you know, the show where we can, you know, say curse words and be a bit more provocative, if you will, is fun, and I like the idea of it. But first of all, a lot of the comedies that really influenced me were multi-camera comedies, everything from Norman Lear's shows to Murphy Brown to Martin are all these multi-camera experiences that I really, really loved. And it seemed like more of a challenge. Well, how do we have these rules and how do we find a way to be creative around that? Maybe, you know, perhaps in the future there is a different version of a show or still have the outlet of film, which I'm really excited about, to get out thoughts that don't necessarily fit in this format. But I like the challenge. I embrace it, and me and my friends enjoy figuring that out.
You know, earlier we played that part of your comedy where your teachers would say to you, you're not like the others. You're special.
Yes.
Did any of your teachers get in touch with you after your sitcom went on the air?
I maintained, there was one teacher that's very important to me. Very, very important to me. Corinne Van Meter. And we maintain a certain correspondence throughout, before the show was on the air. And I don't want to lose touch with her. She's so important to me. And literally changed my life. I mean, in fifth grade, we did a morning news program, and she told me that I was going to produce this morning news program. And every day, first of all, we did everything from picking out my co-anchor, the theme song, the format, the writing, the joke of the day. And she said, you're going to produce this show. We'll go in on the weekends. She would come in on the weekends, and she said, you're going to produce this show. And she would give me an hour during class to go off and write the script for the next day, which she would then take home and type and, you know, reformat so we could have scripts for the next day. It's like literally changed my life. That was such an important experience. I mean, without, you know, her even showing me that that was an option, I don't know where I'd be, to be very honest with you. So that, very specifically her, I want to always keep contact with, because she's so important to me.
I love that story.
Yeah, I would write, and every day, I mean, I could say it now because she took me out. She took me to see my first play. She took me go to she took me to like North Carolina School of the Arts. It's a college that was down the street from me, you know, and she took me there and on the weekends and showed me how production worked and showed me those things. So I always, you know, felt like a producer. I always felt like an actor. I always felt like a writer since that time, just knowing that it was an option. I wrote a poem once, and she called the news and got me on the news, like the local news for it.
Wow.
I mean, just genuinely a beautiful soul and an amazing teacher who changed my life. It really, really changed my life.
I'm glad you're still in touch with her.
Absolutely. You can't lose touch with her. She's such a, you know, an amazing soul.
That's wonderful.
I hope she hears this. I love her.
Well, Gerard, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is really fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Gerard Carmichael co-created and stars in the NBC sitcom The Carmichael Show. Its second season is being shown Sunday nights. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album by jazz legend and saxophonist Sonny Rollins, who is now 85. The album collects live recordings made between 1979 and 2012. Kevin says the best of it is choice.
Sonny Rollins in concert in 2012. He seems to have given up on studio recording in favor of live compilations. The new Holding the Stage is volume 4 in his roadshow series. Rollins is very self-critical, doesn't enjoy listening to himself, and doesn't spend too much time deliberating over what to put out once he finds enough music he doesn't hate. There are a couple of real gems here. Disco Monk from 1979 is the earliest entry yet in the Roadshow series. We'll be right back. That's classic post-1970 Sonny Rollins. He surfs over the band, taking rhythmically charged solos that may not be so melodically complex. You can hear why the Rolling Stones wanted to record with him. Episodes like that are why people turn out to hear him now. Still, the album Holding the Stage is a mixed bag. The sound isn't always good, and as in concert, he doesn't always sound highly inspired. On a tune from 2001, Sonny's staccato bounce and the iffy recording can make his tenor sax sound like a bassoon. Stephen Scott on piano with Bob Cranshaw on electric bass, building a launching pad for the Boss. When Rollins steps up, he and drummer Harold Sumney conduct a dialogue in rhythm. Sonny Rollins tips his hat there toward the model for that blues, John Coltrane's Mr. PC. I hope we hear more from that 96 Paris concert. Holding the Stage also has a meandering solo improvisation in Rollins' modern style, where he flits from one theme to another without alighting anywhere for long. He touches on nursery rhymes, the French national anthem, and the hit of 1868, The Daring Young Man on the Flying Trapeze. Jazz listeners pretty much all revere Sonny Rollins, even those of us who prefer his more intricate early works. He does know how to stay the course. He's been in what I think of as his late phase for the last 40 years.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and Tone Audio and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed Holding the Stage, the new album of live recordings by Sonny Rollins. After we take a short break, Maureen Carrigan will review a new memoir by Betsy Lerner about trying to understand her 80-something-year-old mother. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. In her new memoir, The Bridge Ladies, middle-aged baby boomer Betsy Lerner invites herself into her mother's long-running bridge game as a way of trying to understand a generation that still seems to play its cards too close to its chest. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
As America's population ages, we're going to be seeing a lot more of these kinds of books. I'm talking about memoirs written by adult children about the extreme adventures of caring for and reconnecting with their elderly parents. At the forefront of this emerging genre, of course, are cartoonist Roz Chast's brilliant graphic memoir, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant?, and George Hodgman's deeply affecting and absurdist, Bettyville. Now, Betsy Lerner in The Bridge Ladies ups the ante, to mix my card metaphors. She writes not only of re-entry into the life of her then 83-year-old mother, Roz, but also of becoming a kind of auxiliary member of Roz's Bridge Club, which has been meeting in a suburb of New Haven, Connecticut, every Monday for over 50 years. Because Lerner's focus is wider, and because her mother, Roz, is still very much alive and with it, this memoir is messier, more open-ended than its predecessors. The relationship between Lerner and her mother is still in process, just like those bridge games. Lerner tells readers at the outset of her book that she and her mother never were close, and that back when she was a deliberately lumpen 1970s teenager, all attitude and black Grateful Dead t-shirts, she disdained those ladies who showed up in the afternoons to play bridge, resplendent in shimmery nylons and fresh manicures. The ladies, all Jewish, were comfortably married to Jewish men, and only one of the five worked outside the home. As Lerner says of her younger self, "I was after bigger game. I was already reading Anais Nin and Henry Miller." Lerner did escape to New York, but after a couple of decades, she, her husband, and daughter were pulled back to New Haven by a job offer. Then Lerner's mother needed help recuperating after surgery, and Lerner offered to move back into her childhood home for a week. That's when she encountered the Bridge Ladies again. They turned up at the door, smaller and slower, some of them now widowed, all still beautifully groomed and offering home-cooked comfort food. Lerner became more curious about their lives, and especially about the inner life of her own emotionally closed mother. She asked the ladies if she could sit in on their Monday bridge club. As it turns out, she became a regular for almost 3 years. You can imagine the dire Lifetime movie tailspin that this memoir could have fallen into. Lerner coming to appreciate the Bridge Ladies' wisdom and jello molds, the Bridge Ladies smoking marijuana for the first time under Lerner's expert tutelage. But fortunately, Lerner's skepticism, as well as the contained nature of the relationship with her mother and the Bridge Ladies, keep the saccharine quotient low. Lerner not only learns to play bridge adequately, but also learns a certain amount of personal history during those 3 years. Flawless Betty, for instance, had dreams of becoming an actress. Lerner's mother, Roz, goes into a little more detail about her own struggle with depression and the loss of a toddler daughter. But the most surprising revelation here is not so much what the bridge ladies say, but rather the fact that they don't say much at all. Lerner tells us that she began sitting in on the bridge club, hoping to find remnants of a 1970s encounter group. She even nudged the ladies with intrusive questions about their husbands and sex lives. But to her dismay, what Lerner found was that week after week, year after year, her mother and the other bridge ladies met for a nice lunch complete with napkin rings, chatted about events like births and graduations, and then chiefly concentrated on playing bridge. Lerner says, "I've learned by now that their reticence is largely generational. For them, the word share meant splitting a sandwich." speaking of her own generation's ready willingness to discuss therapy, divorces, and colonoscopies at cocktail parties, Lerner says, to the bridge ladies, our lives must look like a massive oil spill off the Carolinas. The very fact that the bridge ladies keep bravely playing on year after year through illness and loss and the indignities of old age is something Lerner comes to see as admirable. She's right. But there's also a sadness to this smart and colorful memoir, a recognition that some distances can't be bridged between loved ones from different generations, no matter how ardent the desire or devoted the effort.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Bridge Ladies by Betsy Lerner. If you'd like to catch up on this week's interviews you missed, like my onstage interview with Questlove, my interview with Tom Hanks, or Dave Davies' interview about the working relationship between Hillary Clinton and President Obama when she was his Secretary of State, check out our podcast. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, offering online consumer tools and reviews dedicated to promoting fairness and transparency about local service pricing and quality. More information is available at angieslist.com. And from Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles, at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.